Welcome to Episode 6 of Read and Succeed. I'm your host, Dave Campbell, here on your community radio station, 106.5 FM, WFMP LP Louisville, part 2 in a four-part series on Hungarian novelist and 2019 National Book Award winner, Lesno Krasznahorkai, today. Exclusive content from PEN America and the author himself on the back half of the show. Stay tuned.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Greetings to all Democracy Now! Listeners on Pacifica affiliate Forward Radio, 106.5 FM, WFMP LP in Louisville, Kentucky. This grassroots community radio station relies on volunteer power and your financial support to continue broadcasting the progressive national and homegrown local programming you've come to expect from Forward Radio. At a time when our public airwaves are being gobbled up by corporate interests, here's an open mic dedicated to local voices, civic engagement, and community empowerment. Please go to forwardradio.org and pledge your generous support today. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Read Succeed. This is our second episode in a four-episode series reading and reviewing the works of 2015 Man Booker International Prize and 2019 National Book Award winner, Hungarian novelist and screenwriter Lesno Krasznahorkai. The four texts in the series are Mr. Krasznahorkai's self-described creative quadrilogy, Satan Tango, first published in 1985, the topic of the previous episode of Read and Succeed, The Melancholy of Resistance, first published in 1989, the topic of today's episode of Read and Succeed, War and War, first published in 1999, the topic of the next episode of Read and Succeed, and lastly, Krasznahorkai's 2019 National Book Award for Translated Literature winner, Baron Vinkheim's Homecoming, first published in 2016 and translated into English in 2019 for New Directions Publishing by Czechoslovakian translator Otle Mozet, the topic for Episode 8 of Read and Succeed. As we quoted Mr. Krasznahorkai from a September 2019 interview with the Paris Review in the last episode, I've said it 1,000 times that I always wanted to write just one book, Satan Tango, Melancholy, War and War, and Baron. This is my one book. Read and Succeed has also been honored with special content permissions from the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and PEN America and the 92nd Street Young Men's and Young Women's Hebrew Association in New York City to broadcast some of Krasznahorkai's rare English interviews, mostly given in the last decade, as part of this series. Learn more about the Library of Congress at loc.gov. Learn more about PEN America at pen.org. Learn more about the 92Y at 92Y.org. Deepest thanks to these prestigious organizations. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. We're going to move right into reviewing book two in the series, Lesno Krasznahorkai's mysteriously dark and light 1989 novel, The Melancholy of Resistance. To learn more about the author's personal biography and an analysis of his writing career within a larger context of modern Hungarian history, we cordially invite you to listen to episode 5 of Read and Succeed, where we reviewed his 1985 dystopian masterpiece, Satan Tango. You can access that episode at readandsucceed.net and follow the links to our social media suite. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to us on YouTube. All of Read and Succeed's archive podcast links are located at forwardradio.org, where they are available for download on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Google Play. As always, we thank our listeners in the downtown Louisville service area, where Read and Succeed is broadcast on Forward Radio, 106.5 FM, WFMP LP Louisville, at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays, 1 p.m. on Thursdays, and 8 p.m. on Fridays, all Eastern Standard Time. It is probably a good idea to go back and listen to Read and Succeed's Episode 5 review of Lesno Krasznahorkai's first novel, Satan Tango, or better yet, go back and actually read Satan Tango, before listening to this Episode 6 review of his second novel, The Melancholy of Resistance, or better yet, reading The Melancholy of Resistance, because in many ways, The Melancholy of Resistance would not exist without Satan Tango. In many ways, The Melancholy of Resistance, written and published in the late 1980s, is an aesthetic revision of Satan Tango, written in the late 1970s. The same as the next book in this series, War and War, written and published in the late 1990s, is a creative revision of Melancholy. And so on with Baron Vinkheim's Homecoming, all constituting the creative whole of Mr. Krasznahorkai's one book, as previously mentioned per the author himself. I wasn't satisfied with the first novel, and that's why I wrote the second. I wasn't satisfied with the second, so I wrote the third, and so on. The nature of looking at a revision, however, is that the observer can recognize both what existed originally, what has been changed, and potentially discern the reason for the update on the part of the reviser themselves. The Melancholy of Resistance, like Satan Tango, ultimately documents in a very contemporary literary way the mental, physical, and spiritual damage to the Hungarian mind, body, and soul after nearly a century of harsh Soviet-style communism, or the only slightly milder Hungarian-style communism, from 1949 to 1989, a toll captured in many of Krasznahorkai's writings, as it actually existed in 20th century Eastern European reality, as an almost meteorological weather pattern of paranoia that at best manifests itself in a pervasive, never-ending drizzle of socio-economic decay, or at worst manifests itself in a climactic, almost apocalyptic level of mayhem. But whereas Satan Tango, with his narrative of the inhabitants of a poor, isolated collective society in rural Hungary being preyed upon by a returning member and driven into self-destruction and submission to the communist state in an almost cartoonist display of proud partial willingness, and written at a time when life outside of communism in Hungary and Eastern Europe was still utterly unimaginable, deals with these dark themes in a manner of utter pessimism and captivity, The Melancholy of Resistance, written in the final years of the Communist Hungarian People's Republic, and published the year it ultimately collapsed in 1989, deals with these same themes but with the introduction of a fundamentally new element, and the main literary distinction this reviewer feels separates it from Satan Tango: hope. The characters in Satan Tango, as best represented by the burned-out peasant Futaki, only hope to carve out their own meager, ill-begotten share in a never-ending cycle of socio-economic paranoia they cannot control, and only escape this cycle by stubbornly setting out alone and, assumedly, initiating their own cycle of much of the same. The main characters in The Melancholy of Resistance, however, somehow manage to find, in their own uniquely Hungarian way, some hope of escape from the bleakness of their present circumstances, albeit if only on an intellectual plane. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. The Melancholy of Resistance is, as Satan Tango and all of László Krasznahorkai's works were described in the previous episode of Read and Succeed, a demanding read. High late 20th and early 21st century postmodern literature in the genre of American poet E.E. Cummings, written not to sell at a bookstore, but to push the conventional use of the written word solely for the creative pleasure of the artists themselves. Like Satan Tango, The Melancholy of Resistance has no paragraphs. Period, commas, and semicolons all abound, managing another absolutely electric Hungarian to English translation on the part of Hungarian-British poet George Zirtes. But all of this is ordered into only 8 approximately 40-page blocks of nonstop prose that, like the paranoia and feeling of impending overarching doom in the novel, is completely unrelenting. Like the influences of Dostoevsky, Kafka, and Faulkner that Mr. Krasznahorkai references in the interview with PEN America during the second half of this broadcast, The Melancholy of Resistance is visibly a dense, existential stream of literary consciousness. The setting of The Melancholy of Resistance is a small, unnamed, provincial Hungarian city that, while being a major upgrade from the filthy, decaying collective farm of Satan Tango, is still written by Krasznahorkai as an isolated, somewhat pathetic place that has seen better days. The city is inhabited by small, mostly unnamed, provincial Hungarians who, while not being the filthy, decaying peasants of Satan Tango, are still written by Krasznahorkai as an isolated, somewhat pathetic people, completely at the mercy of whatever nefarious paranoias or plans decide to descend on their city. In Satan Tango, the devil arrives on the scene in the form of the clown-like confidence man, false prophet, and state informant Irenaeus, and his tough guy, gypsy enforcer disciple Petrina. But in The Melancholy of Resistance, the end of the city's world is announced on otherwise benign circus flyers posted all over the usual public places that read as follows: a spectacle, an extraordinary spectacle, the biggest whale in the world, and other sensational secrets of nature, in Kossuth Square, just off the Market Square, December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Following a successful European tour. Entrance 50F, children and members of the armed services, half price, a spectacle, an extraordinary spectacle. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. The Melancholy of Resistance opens like Satan Tango with the sound of ominous alarms resonating externally, the sound of ominous plans resonating internally, and an already predetermined hunch that whatever is mysteriously coming down the road toward the city is going to confirm the former and bring the latter to fruition. The character we are first introduced to is the middle-aged Miss Plouffe, standing in a train station in late November, a relatively bourgeois woman from the unnamed capital city, returning to the nominally proletariat unnamed town to visit relatives, and who senses a very subtle, very anxious, very dark change in the place since her last visit, seen in broken streetlights previously lit, trash blowing around the streets, exceptionally cold, windy weather for that time of year, rumors of an exotic circus attraction arriving along with a mysterious circus performer named the Prince, standing before it and giving a speech, and irregular and canceled train service that lands her on the final stage of her journey in the same car as the unwashed masses she despises, and where, a common theme in the text. She seeks inner escape from external hardship, in her bourgeois case, the drunk, smelly workmen on the carriage that want to chat with her, by engaging in inner reflection and dialogue on matters of a more orderly and hopeful nature. In her bourgeois case, fine food and possessions. A literary device seen nowhere in Saint and Tango, including from that novel's ultimate victim, Esty, as she seeks solace from the hardships of the world through suicide, the dialogue in that text remaining completely external throughout. As Miss Plouffe reaches her destination, she sees the circus flyers for the whale exhibit posted around town, even sees the giant corrugated steel box trailer containing the stuffed carcass of the whale being towed by a tractor into Kossuth Square off in the distance, and quietly concludes that it is, quote, plain enough Miss Esther was about some such mischief right now. Mrs. Esther, we find out, is a peer to Miss Plouffe, a permanent resident of the town, one whose, quote, scandalous past, loose morals, and currently confused family situation make her a perennial topic of conversation among the other bourgeois ladies in the local grapevine, but who, in more recent days, has used the relative decline of the city's condition to work herself into leadership of the local women's committee and, as we see her when introduced by Krasnohorke, has worked herself into the affections and bed of the local security captain of the state secret police, leveraging all her newly achieved positions and powers to begin reforming the city according to her desires in a, quote, movement for moral rearmament, whose agenda is little more than unleashing her inner fascist until then hidden under her gaudy clothing, jowls, and, quote, punctilious and pushy manner. The invitation of the traveling circus's whale exhibit, along with its rumored prince figure, elevating the universal paranoia of an already universally paranoid Hungarian town, was Miss Esther's first step in this process, an act meant to open a space in the minds of the townfolk to receive new and novel ideas. As part of our critical analysis, the character of Mrs. Esther, presence of the security captain and the circus act and its impending doom slowly creeping towards a closed, anxious society, and the creative echoes of Satan Tango must be recognized. The name Esther is long, mature Hungarian form of the name Esti, the young, developmentally challenged girl in Satan Tango, whose own act of ambition and free agency to control her existence, in her case suicide, served ultimately as the catalyst for the local security captains, and ultimately the communist state's, end goal of totalitarian control of even the lowest levels of society. The slick, sinister, clown-like act of Irmaeus and Petrina, inching ever closer to the village, simply being the mechanism that set everything into motion. In The Melancholy of Resistance, Krasnohorke has merely reversed their order. Esty, Mrs. Esther, still marginalized by society, has risen to the top. The security captain, now the one being manipulated, sits at the bottom. And the whale exhibit Miss Plouffe sees shrouded in an enormous box of sheet metal in the town's market square, and whomever the prince is, are just another round of devils that will lead the dance. What Mrs. Plouffe and Mrs. Esther are hiding from everyone, however, and where Krasnohorke separates The Melancholy of Resistance from Satan Tango, are two main characters that occupy the central 6 of 8 chapters, actually 40-page blocks of prose, and two characters that give the narrative and the reader at least some modicum of hope that the present darkness and dreariness of their world, although it cannot be escaped on an external level, can at least be escaped on an internal level, or, deeper still, hope that the darkness and dreariness of their current world must at least be part of a larger, potentially provable harmony of existence where light and optimism are also an inevitable part, and where they inevitably must return. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. The lesser of these two characters is Mrs. Esther's estranged husband, Gheorghe Esther, a retired music teacher and lecturer, a member of the Hungarian intelligentsia long since withdrawn from the complexities and evils of the surrounding world and his marriage, to a latently hypochondriac, jaded, hermit-like existence in his stately pre-communist home, rarely rising from his bed, and when doing so, seeking mental retreat and trying to reorder Western music's current musical scale, the fixed schedule of notes formulated by 17th-century German musical theorist Andreas Werkmeister, whose rigid arithmetical focus on equal temperament he feels creates an artificial, unnatural, altogether compromised foundation on which many imperfections in modern Western art, aesthetics, and philosophy, to include Stalinism, ultimately flow. It should also be critically noted that the central 6 out of 8 chapters of The Melancholy of Resistance, as well as Hungarian cinematic master Béla Tarr's haunting year 2000 adaptation of The Melancholy of Resistance, are both entitled Werkmeister's Harmonies. Mr. Esther feels that a new musical scale based on mathematics' other dimension, its infinite possibilities and uncertainties, is possible, that this scale would be more reflective of the infinite possibilities and uncertainties built into our infinite and uncertain universe, and that, if developed, it would ultimately draw the Western, or at least Hungarian, mind, then bogged down in no shortage of failed philosophical and political systems, back into a more organic, harmonious relationship with the natural world. Naturally, no one in town listens or cares, except for one individual, the hero and heart of The Melancholy of Resistance, Mr. Esther's young caretaker, Voluska. Janos Veluska is, we find out, Mrs. Plouffe's developmentally challenged only son from her first failed marriage, whom she and the rest of the family have disowned, and whom the unnamed city more tolerates than accepts as a sort of village halfwit. A simpleton, a dreamer, gentle and harmless, an idiot savant, newspaper delivery man, whose mind is permanently fixed in the heavens above, and who devotedly attends to the aging and ailing Mr. Esther, and in whom Mr. Esther sees a mind capable of understanding his theories. In many ways, the character of Mr. Esther in The Melancholy of Resistance is merely a distant echo of the character of the Doctor in Satan Tango, who was merely an even more distant echo of the author Lázár Krásnahorkai himself, misanthropic and self-exiled from reality into a windowless world of simply observing one's own intellect as a substitute for reality. But, as stated, The Melancholy of Resistance introduces hope into the equation, and whereas Satan Tango ends with the world-weary doctor sitting down to write that world-weary novel, in The Melancholy of Resistance, the mystical and naive character of Veluska not only tempers and balances Mr. Esther's pessimism, but also tempers and balances the pessimism of the entire narration of the text itself. In one of the most unique, evocative sequences this reviewer has observed in either literature or cinema, the character of Veluska is introduced to the audience by Krásnahorkai in the novel, and by Bélatar in the film adaptation, showing up after hours at a local working-class bar, clearing the stools and tables, and leading all its thoroughly inebriated patrons in a physical reenactment of the solar system, with one drunken regular standing in the center of the pub as the sun, one spinning around him as the earth, and one spinning around him as the moon, with, in a sample of Krásnahorkai's absolutely brilliant prose, Veluska himself both directing and reacting to the cosmic narrative. Soon thereafter, the annoyed bartender shuts off the lights and throws all the dancing celestial bodies out stumbling into the dark streets, and Veluska to wander to Mr. Esther's house to help tuck him in for the night. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. But in the town's market square still remains the exhibit of the whale, surrounded by an inner ring of rumors and anxiety about the sinister prince figure that travels with it, speaking unsettling and unraveling words to the towns he visits, and an outer ring of the machinations of the true hand behind the New World Order, soon to eclipse all of the above, Mrs. Esther. As Veluska wanders by the square even before the whale exhibit is opened for viewing on December 1st, the paranoid energies its presence generates has already started to capture the town's citizens in its orbit in the form of small clusters of mostly common people gathered around it at various distances, nervously whispering amongst themselves, and randomly giving anyone who comes near them an unfriendly visual interrogation, and these clusters seem to imperceptibly multiply in number and nervousness with each passing hour. Sensing the city's impending doom and sensing the hand of the physically and mentally robust Mrs. Esther behind everything, the town's bourgeois middle class reaches out to the only individual they feel can defuse the situation, the physically and mentally exhausted Mr. Esther, and the estranged couple engages in a game of political cat and mouse that Mr. Esther ultimately loses. The corrugated steel of the exhibit is lowered, the whale is displayed, the anxious crowds continue to gather and cluster, public services and public order grinds to a halt, and on the third day, the mysterious prince figure, never seen in the novel, emerges as it was rumored he did in other towns and delivers a speech to the masses, never heard in the novel, that sends them all on a rampage of indiscriminate rioting, looting, assaults, and murders that Veluska and Mr. Esther can merely observe. Both are capable of experiencing internal and somewhat hopeful psychological and philosophical epiphanies during the madness, but both still remain quite incapable of exporting their thoughts outside of their own minds. The masses, they realize, one of a long line of Krásnahorkai's subtle critiques of mid-20th century Soviet communism, couldn't exactly pin their fears and resulting angers on anything, so they simply blamed their fears and resulting angers on everything and attacked accordingly. Veluska and Mr. Esther, in the novel's defining creative symbol, are able to resist the masses, but only internally, and only through a melancholic loyalty and solidarity to their own psychological life and to one another. Eventually, the state secret police from outside the city are alerted to the carnage. They descend quickly and in force with tanks and helicopters to restore order, and Mrs. Esther, in her final coup de grace, is placed in total command of the town, randomly directing the movement of military units, and her, quote, movement for moral rearmament is implemented. The first order of which is driving her ex-husband, Mr. Esther, to the rural regions of Hungary seen in Satan Tango. The second order of which is finding Veluska and having him committed to a psychiatric hospital. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell.
Alumbra luna llena, alumbra.
What we are going to play next is an audio clip from an interview that Irish novelist Colm Tóibín conducted with Lázaro Krásna Horké at the 2014 PEN America World Voices Festival in New York City, New York. Two elite figures of contemporary literature on stage. Mr. Tóibín has been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in the United Kingdom 3 times and won the Lambda Literary Award in the U.S. as an LGBT author in 2004. And Mr. Krásna Horké has won the Man Booker Prize 2 times for international and translated literature and the United States National Book Award for translated literature 1 time. Excellent interview that Krásna Horké gave during his press circuit for his 2008 novel Sable There Below, translated into English in 2013, winning the Man Booker Prize in 2015, a period when Mr. Krásna Horké's writing was at its most Asian, having traveled there frequently in his post-communist career. Unlike the interview we broadcast last week, which was specific to the text of Satan Tango, this interview covers a whole range of topics. Mr. Krásna Horké's perspective on Hungarian communism versus Chinese communism, European history versus Asian history, and the Hungarian language versus the English language. Great content, and our sincerest thanks to the team at PEN America for allowing us to broadcast this conversation. Learn more about PEN America at PEN.org. Learn more about Colm Tóibín at ColmTóibín.com. Learn more about Lázaro Krásna Horké at KrásnaHorké.hu. And enjoy. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell.
Thank you very much for coming. Lázaro, are there two sides of the brain? The left side and the right side. And in one side, you store information, images. Someone tells you something, memories. And then what happens if you're writing is that those things, something, becomes rhythm, moves into sound, or moves into something you can work with, moves into a sentence. And what I want to ask you at the beginning is if you could give us an idea of how your sentences work, or how they begin. If you think in sentences, and as you're working, how you compose a sentence?
You know, I hear always sentences. Maybe not with this or that side of my brain, but a little bit in the downstairs. There are actually one huge sentences. I hear, like in a huge space, I hear only one sentences. Everybody speaks and everything speaks. And this is a big chaos of speeches, you know, and I try to find a line in this big, huge chaos and pick up one very small part of this sentence and follow these sentences. I don't know where can I find the rhythm of the sentence, but this huge sentence has a big tempo and speed and rhythm too. And I can say really absolutely often that I cannot choose a style or I cannot choose some way how can I depict something, but I try to hear in this huge chaotic space this one chaotic sentence and somehow to follow that. And if I catch it somewhere, there is a point. After that, I try to follow this one. And everything is ready, not only in the literary world, but in the existence, I think so. Everything and everybody is there. I didn't need, and I don't need, to make sentence or sentences. It's enough to hear this kind of line, you know. And the characters in my books, they exist. This is not a product of my brain or my wish or something like that, you know.
I notice in this book, Sable There Below, which is by a new translator, that I'm hearing still a sound in the sentences that is yours, that it hasn't changed because of the new translator coming, that it fundamentally belongs to you as a sort of DNA of style. And I wonder just one more thing, or maybe two more things about it. You begin a sentence and you have a sound for it. Now, at what point do you know the sentence has to end, for example? I mean, you keep adding to it. You have a rhythm for it. You interrupt yourself in the middle of the sentence to say something else, but the rhythm remains under the sentence. You're holding the rhythm almost as though you're a singer or a drummer, or you're involved somehow or other in making music. Does that make any sense to you?
This is a difficult question because this is a book which was written not by me, you know. This book, The English Sable There Below, was written by Ottilie Muset. She is the translator, but actually every word in this book, every word, there are some. Every word was written by Ottilie. Yeah. Not by me.
Yes.
And this is.
And George Sears says in, yes, in the other books, it was George,
yeah,
who's a poet.
Yeah.
And you expect that if a poet translates a prose writer, you will get a poet's style. But what I'm noticing is that, yeah, I'm getting your style in both translations. It's coming through, almost like water coming, yeah, through.
It would be very interesting, maybe also for me or for a few people, what is the distance now between Ottilie's Sable There Below and George, the other translator of my first books in English. There are some difficulties, I felt it. But the language which I use, this is really very close to the music, I think so. I make also music at home, not for people or...
What,
but
you,
I live
you play,
always...
You, what
I
you
play
do?
Piano, a lot of instruments I use. Yeah.
What do you play?
Piano, guitar, cello or... What does it mean?
Cello, yeah, cello.
And I don't know. If I am in Japan or China, I listen to music and I love it very much. Next day I go to an instrument shop and I buy this instrument and I try to somehow. When I, for example, when I wrote The War and War, an old novel in English, I was in Crete. For a few months, and that was very interesting. That was Eastern, like here, for a few weeks or 1 week. And that was a little bit different, this Eastern in Crete. In Crete, that was a little bit different. And the music was also very different. Here, this Eastern was a big experience for me to go somewhere north on the Broadway in a church, a family church. The gospel was absolutely fantastic. And in our time, in Crete, that was two old men in a village, next to my village, when I worked. And they had so fantastic old music, and that was so unbelievably strict and disciplined, beautiful, with an instrument whose name is lira. This is absolutely fantastic. And of course, next day I tried to find, but it was not so easy to find it. And so I collect different instruments and I play for a while. And after that, it's enough. And the next music and the next instruments come.
Sometimes with a sentence, you're like a child with a toy, and it's Christmas, and there's another toy has arrived.
Yeah.
That you simply won't let go a sentence. That there's a sense of... Once you start, your mind begins to move and glitter.
Maybe not my brain.
Your what? Your voice.
Yeah.
Your voice.
Not my voice.
Right?
Not my voice, yeah. I told you very often that I hear speeches around me, you know, and I follow this. And this is not only
you hear voices.
Symbolized. Yeah. For example, here too. So many different, not only people,
yes, but
speeches.
Yes, but Laszlo, the voice that you use to make the sentences is also very controlled and exact.
Because
I mean, it isn't just a voice you hear and it, yeah, appears on the page.
But after
phrase by phrase by phrase,
but after,
you are...
after. If I catch a sentence, yeah, and I follow it, if I... tell me, okay, that's it. This is the sentence. After that, when I write down, of course, I control that and I make corrections and so on. Yeah, of course. But this is a work after.
Music is one thing. Perhaps also the circus and the sense of a tightrope, of you walking along a tightrope with a sentence, where if it doesn't work, it's a disaster because you will fall. Do you find sometimes that you need a certain moment to work, you know, that inspiration becomes really important, or that sometimes it doesn't happen for you? Months or days where these sentences don't lift.
Yeah, there are some very decision moments, yeah. And this whole catching process belongs to this moment. Actually, every important thing...
Every what?
Every important thing happens in that moment for me. And I can build sentences or something different also from this moment. I go back and back again and again to this moment. And I try to understand somehow. This is not so easy to understand the moment. And this is actually the lock where can I catch this craziness of the sentences and speeches in the universe.
You say, and I think anyone who knows your work will understand how important music is. I wonder how important travel has been for you, moving.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. This whole story started with the fact that I, almost until my 30, I couldn't make travel. That was a negative space of traveling. That was also a kind of travel, because that was in my mind, that was in my desire, that I sat in a very small country, and there in a very small town, and there in a very small house, and there is a very small room, and so on, you are boring. And there I dreamed about, what could be there, for example, in America, in New York, or something like that. And until almost my 30, it was absolutely impossible for me. And that was even so important in my life than after 87. 87 was the first year when I could make
a trip. So where did you go first?
First to West Berlin. That was 87. And West Berlin, of course, that was one of the most interesting and fascinating city for me, especially because the city was absolute full with people with wands everywhere.
Oh, people with wounds.
Okay. Wounds.
Okay, yeah, yeah, okay.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
That's
so,
okay.
And that was actually the democracy of the wounded people.
Wounded people, yeah.
Yeah. And it was unbelievable for me because I felt there among the people as a kind of people like home, first in my life. That was my first. And after that, 1990, because of an accident, I went to the Far East. And that was a beginning. On a way down there. Asian.
And New York?
New York was a little bit later. And the reason was Allen Ginsberg, who was a friend of mine. So many people could say that, and I am very happy that I can say also that. Although I met Allen...
Let's start, explain. Where did you meet Ginsberg?
Pardon? When?
Where?
In New York.
Right.
In New York. In
and,
New York, because
how,
we had...
Then?
We had a common friend, and okay. I came to New York because I wanted to check some scenes for my new novel, War and War.
I want to stop you for a second. Okay. So you're already writing your New York book, War and War, before...
No. That was in the process.
But you were imagining it.
Yes. Yes, I imagined some scenes in New York,
yeah.
But I needed to check what does it like, and it is possible to go from this point left or right, and I had to be here because I couldn't imagine me, you know? And so I could live in Ellen's flat, not too far from here actually. And Ellen was one of my helper for this novel because I had some problem because the main character of this novel is a very colorful, extreme figure. And that's why I needed a very neutral, monochrome background. But New York was every other than monochrome and neutral. And that was a very difficult problem to solve that in a literary way. And Ellen could help with very wise advice.
And when was the first time that you went to China?
That was 1990.
Right. And could you describe that to me? Just arriving in China and the effect that China had on you.
On a wonderful Saturday afternoon, the sun shined. My two children played in a street where I lived in Hungary. Out of the blue, the phone rang, and so on. And somebody called me. Somebody called me that, sorry, I have to manage something very briefly, and that's why Imeria says, could you have some mood to come with me in 1 week to Ulaanbaatar because of a Genghis Khan conference?
A Genghis Khan
conference? Of course, right. I answered.
Yes.
Of course, why not?
Yes.
After such a question, yes. People cannot say no.
No, yeah, okay.
And in 1 week, I was in Ulaanbaatar, but not at the Genghis Khan conference. There was a Genghis Khan conference in Ulaanbaatar, 1990, but Ulaanbaatar was so unbelievable, really. That was my first meeting with an absolutely different world. I couldn't imagine, actually, that such a different world can exist than Mongolia. Mongolia or Mongolai, I don't know.
Mongolia, yeah.
Mongolia. Like Mongolia, and in the daylight, I walked in the city, that was not a normal city, and that was absolutely shocked. I saw things there, and I couldn't try to understand it, because that was ununderstandable, really. That was so far from my world, and I was there, I've been there so without reason, you know, and so fast, and I couldn't check it. And I sat with my friend, acquaintance, in a so-called hotel room in Ulaanbaatar. What a hotel was it? Jesus Maria. And I show my friend the map that, you know, this is the world. There is somewhere Budapest. This is Ulaanbaatar, and this is Peking. Could you imagine that we can go again to this area? No. In this case, we have a chance only now, and just only one chance we have to go now to Peking. And that was the reason that we got a train ticket to Peking. And suddenly I was in Peking. That was also a fantastic experience.
Did you feel underneath the society?
1990.
Did you feel underneath the society a sense of an old religion, of an old culture? For example, the modern buildings or the communist regime was merely a veneer, a front, something strange that had been sort of just a screen, but that it was very easy to pull the screen back and find the other thing.
What more, I was absolutely blind for its new facades, Maoist and red carpet. I couldn't see that. I saw only this old one, the old city. But that was very strange.
Could you go into more detail about that? Because I think it's a difficult idea. Because when you're there now in China, that is really what is given to you. That is the constant, is what has been created in the society over the last, say, 40 years. Mm. But it's very difficult sometimes to find anything beneath that that has endured, if you're an outsider.
Yeah. The essence was for me, actually, not to find this old China, but to understand how does it possible that I found there an absolute permanent, a constant history at time. I came from Europe, and in Europe we have an absolute cutted historic time or a feeling about the history. Everything was collapsed, and after that, from the zero came something, a new start, a new beginning. But in China, that was a little bit different, because when I was there, people had this feeling the history is a constant process.
And Japan?
Oh, Japan was the strangest. Of course, for everybody, is the strangest country. This is a magical country, really, and I don't know why. I've been there a relative lot of times, and I went back again to understand why I can't understand Japan. And I went back to understand it, but without success.
I think for a lot of us here, Hungary is also a sort of mystery.
Hungary?
Yeah, I'm sorry to tell you this. Hungary is a sort of mystery. First of all, the language is so difficult, so strange, and so unlike the other languages around it. Secondly, the way in which, despite communism, certain things survived, houses with books, people who trained their children to play music, a whole bourgeois world that for 45 years stayed indoors, but emerged very clearly in the 1990s. As having really just stayed indoors as though it was raining or something for 45 years, and their grandchildren or their children could emerge in the 90s. What's your background in Hungary? I mean, what sort of world do you come from?
I told you that I'm coming from a very far small town from the southeast part of Hungary. But this is not enough to say about this town. To live there in this small town meant that you are so far from Budapest. And where is Budapest? So far. And we dreamed about first, not about New York, but about Budapest. That someone, maybe we have a chance to go to Budapest and to see Budapest, the big city. And this small town was really absolute far from the world. And that was a town with a bourgeois culture. The communist theory was not too successful in this small town. Poor communist people who believe really in this strange theory suffered there because the people tried to understand what is the communism, but they had an experience only about the Soviet occupation and not about the communist theory. And so everything was very ridiculous for people, the communistic world. We suffered of this absolute big, deep craziness, the idiot speeches of the director of a school or something like that. Everything was like in a circus, you know, for us. And to live in this small city meant also that you were a little bit defense, because a little bit closer, or much closer to Budapest, it could be not possible to live. What means bourgeois town? The Hungarian culture had and has, also today, a very close contact to the German, Austrian-German culture, especially to the German culture. And the Hungarian culture can thank very much for the German culture. And that was it belonged to their daily situation or scenes, that an old man went to the bed to sleep, and before he slept, he read Goethe or Schiller in German. That was general in this small town. And the children had to learn music, for example. And every Sunday afternoon, the children had to play for the guests. That's why I hate, for example, Mozart, because I had
poor Mozart.
I am agree. But every Sunday afternoon, could you imagine you?
It's really difficult for us to find, to trace what your work comes from, what tradition you would place it in, what reading really mattered, that nourished you, that gave you a sense of, I could do that, or I could do better than that. You know, I could try some names, I could just throw some names at you just to see what'll happen. If I said Dostoevsky to you, what would you say? Dostoevsky?
Dostoevsky. Hi, hi.
But when? I mean, were you reading him when you were a teenager?
Yes, yes. The time when I was 10 or 11 or 12, that was a border in the history of the communist Hungary, because approximately that was the time when it was possible to publish the so-called Western literature. First, of course, the classical, and later the contemporary classical, from Faulkner until, I don't know,
Miller
or something.
Give me Faulkner, then.
Faulkner,
When did you read Faulkner first?
Yes, I was a big fan for Faulkner, absolutely. Until today, actually, only that was a big luck for us, that even of the communist party or the cultural life in the communist Hungary, the best poets, best Hungarian poets, the best Hungarian writers couldn't publish their own works, but they had a chance to translate. And that's why we had a fantastic translated literature. And we suffered now, for example, after 1990s, because every Greek writers and poets couldn't translate.
Yeah, they didn't want to.
Yes.
They'd done enough of that. They wanted to publish their own work.
Yeah.
Kafka?
Absolutely. Without Kafka, I couldn't exist. For example, I was 13 years.
I just want to stop you for a second. This is a remote place in Hungary, which is mainly agriculture, with really good library, really good bookshops, really good...
In the family libraries.
Okay.
In the family libraries.
Private libraries.
Private libraries.
Okay.
Yes. And this town were absolutely full with private libraries.
Right. So that the communists didn't burn books.
No. No. Libraries were very, the public libraries were, for example, very popular because you could get the Classica, for example, there, right. In translations. In translation, but the contemporary books you couldn't find there.
Right.
Only in the private family library.
Okay, I've mentioned Kafka, I've mentioned Dostoevsky, we've mentioned Faulkner. Anybody else would come?
Of course. For example, the old Greek poetry, that played a very big role in my youth. Because I came from such a family where, which was, what does it mean? The children of this kind of family were not possible to learn Western languages, live languages, French, English, Germans. It's only old Greek and Latin. That was my punishment there, but later I was very, very, very happy, very, very, very glad. And that's why when I was 14 years old or later, until 18 years old, I read a lot of Greek authors. I enjoyed it, not only the contemporary literature, but also the old. But I can tell you Dante. Because in the gymnasium, in the college, the Hungarian...
You mean in high school?
Yeah. We had a fantastic teacher who had only one patient, and the patient was Dante. And that's why we loved very much Dante, of course. And so this town was a little bit full with some foggy people, you know, like a big camp of some wounded people, of the communism. And we had learned a lot of things of these people. Not only Dante, but also from the daily life. Some legendary figure back and forth on the street. And we saw him and we tried to find who is he. And that it belonged also to the culture.
And cinema?
That was a luck time because that was a time when I was 14, 15, 16 years old. That was a time when we could watch movies by Fellini, Antonioni, Tarkovsky, Bresson. And that was maybe the greatest time for the movie at all. And we enjoyed that. And we could see in a normal cinema, not at home.
Is it possible that some of the roots of your work arise from censorship, arise from the idea that if you were playful, if you were indirect, if you dealt with language as a form of music, that you could publish? Whereas if you wrote down the local conditions of the agricultural workers, they would stop you. Is that possible?
Mm. That was possible, yeah. I don't know, and until today I don't know. Why was it possible to publish my first book, Saturn Tango? Because that was 1985. And 1985, there were no one who believed that in 4 years, everything is over.
Yeah, the future didn't exist, as
no,
it were.
I don't know why. Maybe because this publishing house in Budapest had a director, and he was in the 50s, the most difficult time. In the Hungarian communists, that was the pure terror, and he was a secret police, a main person of the secret police.
Oh, that's very helpful.
And later,
and later, no, because he knew the system, he understood how.
Yeah. And later he became a director of one of the two literary publisher houses, and maybe he tried to show for somebody, I don't know who are this somebody, that he has power. To publish such a book. Saturn Tango is not a typical social realist book.
No, but it's also, it's not optimistic. If I was a communist
stating
Tango, I'd just stop that. That book is dangerous because it's filled with dark imagery. It's filled with pessimism.
Yeah, but I've never met him, this director. Never met
so what
him.
Happened?
Peter Esterházy, a writer of us from my generation, wrote the manuscript to the publisher house, Magvető. That was the name, Magvető.
And where were you living and how were you living? I mean, what were you using instead of money, for example?
I had a job. I had a lot of small jobs after each other. And that was a very simple workers, not always agricultural workers, but sometimes, because that was a provocation also against my family,
And, going to work in the fields was a way of killing your father?
that was the time.
Okay. And You wrote this novel.
Yes,
at
that
night?
Time.
At night? It's filled with night, isn't it?
Night.
Night.
No. Every time. I sat in a bar, or worse than a bar.
Oh, okay.
And I wrote in my head this novel. And if I had some possibility, a chance to find a space at night, I wrote down the text. When I was ready, some pages.
And you knew Peter Esterházy?
Yeah.
How?
I published the text in a literary magazine.
Okay.
That was a small text. And after that, I got from Peter a card. You are a genius. Hugs, Peter. So.
Yeah. And you sent him the book?
No. After that.
After, okay.
Only after that. I needed to hear that you had a genius.
Maybe we'll take some questions from the audience. Great, thank you.
My question goes as follows. The process for the writing is that you're hearing the voices and trying to bring them into control and make some corrections and such. And then we have a wonderful reading of your work, and we're hearing a voice again. And I'm wondering, as you're hearing that voice, whether it resembles the voices that you heard. And as you're hearing this beautiful voice that we heard today, and that wonderful reading, whether you want to, in a sense, control that reading and make corrections, even to your own corrected work.
Thank you very much for your question, because it's not enough to praise this reading only once. Thank you once more, dear Timothy. Of course, I hear the text in English, and I remember what I was written. And there is a similarity, but the English, the essence of the English language is different than my language. Maybe only for my ears, I don't know. Maybe because I cannot speak English, as you hear. But maybe not. And I try to remind my sentences, and I try to follow if Timothy read, how does it sound in my language, what I wrote. And that was, of course, not only similarity, also differences.
And we've got a question over here.
Yes.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could speak more about how the Asian arts and thought inform your writing. You could just speak more about that.
Oh, I can speak maybe too much about this. That was a big challenge to be there and not to enjoy the Asian culture. Asian culture means for me only the Chinese, Japanese culture. I've been never any other countries in Asia. That was even enough. Especially in China, I try to dig a little bit deeper in the old Japanese culture, and especially the architecture, the Shinto architecture, and the Buddhist sculptures, and some painters of the Japanese Middle Age, or the Shinto music, or the Buddhist gardens, or Kyudo, the Japanese archery. And they all influenced me very, very deeply. But until the border, I could enjoy it. But after that, I had a strong desire to understand it. And this is a big mistake in Japan.
Yes, please.
The difference between novels and other forms of art, like a piece of theater or a painting, is that you can take the painting and everything one time, or in 2 hours, you get everything. But with the novel, usually we have days or weeks to read them. But with your sentences and your pages and your paragraphs that go on for pages, it's difficult to stop reading. Or if you do stop, when you start again, you have to start in the middle of a sentence, possibly.
Yeah.
Is that in the kind of the act of the reader reading? Does that enter into your mind about how your works are experienced, or how you experience your works that are like theater or other kinds of art? Or
No. I deal only with literature. And after a while, let me say, in the last 40 years, I dealt only with words. I have only words. And this is all. This is my treasury.
But I think the question is,
yes.
Could you guide us? That, as Charles is asking,
yeah.
If you stop at a certain point, sometimes with you, it's very hard to say, I'll read more next week or I'll read more tomorrow, because you feel you have to go back to the beginning again, and because you're held in a sort of hypnosis.
Yeah. This is also difficult for me. To make an end, because I know that this is not the end. I can repeat only what I told you all a little bit earlier, that I hear absolute infinite sentence, and I try to follow that. And I know when I put a period after a long or much longer sentence, huge sentences, this is artificial thing.
Hi, I'm still interested in how you would characterize the sound of your Hungarian language with the sound of the English language.
It's difficult because to answer this question, I would need a knowledge about the English language. And I can say only something about the Hungarian language. This is a very fragile language. And you have some extreme fine chance to depict a process. You haven't an obligation to say in concreto about something, about the things. You can a little bit remain dim. And I have some idea about the English language. I have some idea about the Spanish and French and German language and Italian and Greek and all. And every language not allowed this dimmy situation in a sentence. For example, in French language, a very short example, there is a part of a text by me where a woman wanted to correct something in a telegram at the post office. And she goes back to the postman and she asks him that, please allow me to correct only one word. And this word is, in English, one word in Hungarian, hiába, in vain. This is two words in English, in vain. But in the French language, doesn't allow to use without a context what is in vain. The Hungarian language allow that much more.
So could you give us the English word again?
In vain.
In vain.
In vain.
Oh, right. Okay.
If somebody impossible or
you do something. Okay.
Yeah, in vain. And this fragile nature of the Hungarian language, I love very much.
I have a quick quote I wanted to give you that was recently given in another lecture in the English-speaking world by a poet, Jeffrey Hill. He said, "The idea that you write to express yourself to me seems revolting. The idea that you write to make glorious or to glorify the art of expressiveness to me seems spot on." In the English-speaking world, we sort of take it as a democratic ideal that if we choose to express ourselves, that's something we should champion. Is that an odd or sort of peculiar activity that you notice in the West? And how does that contrast to the idea of writing for you being a Hungarian?
Difficult question. I shouldn't solve something in my literature or in the literature, I think so. I shouldn't create. I have to choose from my words any. From these words, I can find this line of the big space of the crazy speeches, a line for you, which is suddenly not very personal for you. And if it is success, poor, that's the great, really.
This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. That's it for episode 6 of Read and Succeed. We'll pick up next episode with book number 3 in Krasznahorkai's quadrilogy, War and War, and move one step closer to reviewing his 2019 National Book Award winner for translated literature. This is Read and Succeed. I'm Dave Campbell. Thanks for listening.